of waves of population and then an ebb and a flow.
Sure, that's gone on since the early 1960s with the construction of the various iron ore companies. The first company under construction was Goldsworthy Mining out of Port Hedland, Goldsworthy, Shea Gap, Finnegan Island, and then Hammersley Irons operation in 66 that Tom Price and the establishment of Dampier. Then Paravadoo 69-71, which was put into mothballs and then opened up in production in 1972-73. Then Robe River was done in 1970-71, and prior to that even there was iron ore shipped and produced, I understand, from prior to 1940 from Cockatoo or Coolin Island at Yampi Sound by BHP, where of course the iron ore was sent to Japan.
Is that still being produced there?
One of the islands is still producing, I'm not sure which, at the moment. One's closed and one's still producing.
Well, does that mean that your union's membership's been up and down in numbers?
It has. It would have been because of the high turnover of labour, as I was saying earlier, Wendy, up until the 1980. It was a very transient workforce, even within the iron ore mining companies, because people didn't want to stay here because of the climate, because of the isolation, because there was no support in terms of families. The wages and conditions in those days were not anything special, except that people had access to work large amounts of overtime. Now, by the time 1980 rolled around, that had ceased. Also, the facilities within the communities were nowhere near the standard required to attract a permanent workforce. And there were many, many industrial disputes throughout the 1970s that were primarily related to the accommodation and facilities within the various communities. By the late 70s, most of that had ceased in terms of the facilities were starting to come up to standard. And of course the economy in the rest of Australia had been affected because of international pressures, and unemployment had really become a major issue, to the extent that people took the view, well, I'm in the Pilbara and I have a reasonably well paid job and I have accommodation and the facilities here are improving, I would rather stay here with my family than live in other parts of Australia. And then they developed an ethos out of going to the Pilbara and making a fast buck to staying in the Pilbara and making a long-term commitment.
That's been a bit of a knock lately, hasn't it? A lot of people, with the changing attitudes of big companies like Fitzroy River, a lot of people gone away, they probably thought they stayed.
Well, that's very true. Although I don't think that is a reflection of the Pilbara, rather it's a response to a particular initiative by one employer.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. It's very much depends on a fairly public-spirited or a good industrial relations when you can stop it, because I presume a lot of people would... Yeah, tell me about housing. Do most, say, Hammersley Iron employees live in company houses?
That's correct.
And the same with Road River?
That's correct.
How, and now, then they live in closed towns?
Yes. Up until the early 1980s, all mining communities were closed towns and completely supplied and supported by the mining companies. There was a subtle but nevertheless decisive shift from that by the mining companies in relation to ships with the local shire councils and the government to open those towns up to what would be envisaged by people who live in the capital cities as a normal community, in the sense of open government, so on and so forth. And also the companies gave access to employees to buy their own houses at commercially attractive rates. At the end, if people don't wish to stay in those, when they decide to leave, they can sell them back to the company. And so that has shifted, has assisted that major shift that started subtly in the early 1980s.
I noticed that the Barrett people building houses in Perth, wasn't that a fair way from the Barrett?
It's approximately 25 kilometres. Some of the major employers in the Barrett are building permanent accommodation for their own supervisory staff, engineers and clerical type staff, but in the main, the major body of the workforce, the wages workforce, will live in single men's quarters or in caravan parks, and if they're lucky, they'll get rented accommodation at the princely sum of $300 or $350 a week for basic accommodation.
Oh, now, shall we go back to say
yes, we did.
And do you now?
Yes.
But are you able to exercise that right in a way which makes it easy to do your work, or is it hard?
Well, in the current situation, since the entry of Pico Wall's End and the dispute the action on the 1st of August 1986 by Pico, it is still possible for union officials to access the sites and go around them and conduct business, but it is in a very clinical and a very stifling manner. Wendy, what that means is that if you're an accredited official, you can make an appointment to go and see an industrial officer, and you must go through a security system, and you are escorted onto the site, you're taken to where you want to go, and then you're brought back. You are not allowed to talk to workers unless you're given the express permission of the employer, and that means that the immediate supervisory staff of the worker that you wish to talk to must agree that you can do that.
Mm-hmm. And do they agree?
Not in my experience.
No, I see. So in fact, it's really very difficult for you to find out anything that's going on without the supervisor standing there listening to you.
Oh, that's correct. I've had instances where I've been informed verbally by industrial relations staff of Robe River when I was on an escorted inspection of a workshop, that when a worker came and talked to me, I explained to him that the person that was with me and escorting me was there to observe who I spoke to and what I saw and who I listened to, and the worker spoke to me and asked me for a cigarette and what I was doing there, and when I'd done that, he walked away. At the end of that visit, I was informed by the industrial relations staff of Robe River that I would be sued, the worker would be sued, and the company would seek costs because I stopped the worker from doing his job. In fact, that action has not been implemented by the employer, but it was threatened.
In other words, it's really very, except for observing safety in that, there's very little point in you going on at all.
Well, there are some very good reasons to go on the site, to check wages and conditions, and I have done that, and the employers provided that information as they are required to in terms of the award. It is also important to see workers and observe what they're doing for all sorts of reasons, but it doesn't help if you can't talk to them. But but even within limitations, it's important for union officials to...
So if you have union meetings now, like you have to have them outside the gate, do you?
If we have union meetings now, we have them outside of normal working hours and usually held somewhere within the community, in a car park or at someone's house or...
And is this the people, and since all those people that have cliffs live in a company town and there is no facility, I presume, made available in that town to have union meetings in?
Not usually there's not, unless it's for a specific reason and there's a large meeting. They have approved on occasion the use of certain facilities.
Yeah, which is just since the strike and like that.
There have been a couple of union meetings that have... they have always occurred outside of normal working hours, except for one occasion in my experience where the employer allowed the meeting to take place, but of course didn't pay the workers. It was during normal working hours.
And are the workers, is this intimidating the workers, probably keeping them away from meetings and things to any degree?
I think it's one of the elements that that impacts upon workers, and... they are intimidated by it, and they are affected by it.
Because if they lose their job, they lose their house, and their home, and everything.
That's correct.
How long do they get to get out?
The legal provision in terms of the award is 7 days. It depends upon why they have been terminated and what response they take. In terms of the worker wishes to take it up with the union, and it's proceeded through the Western Australian Industrial Relations Commission, in most instances, it has been achieved that the worker can stay in the accommodation until such time as the matter is finalised within the commission. Parallel to that action, the employer immediately serves upon the worker upon his dismissal a notice that... that legal action will be taken against him if he stays in the accommodation longer than 7 days. The procedure is that he will continue to receive notices from the employer, usually by certified mail, that because he has refused to take notice of the first notice, they are applying to the appropriate district court or whatever to take action to have him evicted. Now, if the worker was reinstated or the matter was sorted out to the satisfaction of the worker within the industrial relations process and he was reinstated or whatever, the parallel action would be stopped. If, however, it wasn't sorted out to the satisfaction of the worker and he wished to stay there, but nevertheless he was terminated and wasn't going to go back on the job, the employer would then implement the legal action in the courts, and it speeds the whole process up for the employer. Instead of him having to wait 4 weeks or 3 months for the legal action to take place, he started the clock ticking from the time the employee was dismissed. And I suppose the other side of it, Wendy, in a practical manner, is that if the worker is dismissed and he ultimately can't get back on the job, then he probably wouldn't want to stay within the community anyway. There probably wouldn't be anywhere else for him to get...
It's intimidating, isn't it? It means you can't... it's all... It seems to me that the sort of whole thing now has become so considered, so everything, there's nothing left to human relations or chance or, oh, that'll be all right, Laurie, you know, give a couple of weeks or, you know... So I think there's no room for manoeuvre much by the worker. It's boom, 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 this happens, you know, it's become like a machine, hasn't it?
Well, I suppose the methodology of it is very inhuman.
That's what it's meant to be.
But nevertheless, that is a result, I suppose, of the nature of the way things have occurred in the Pilbara, because it has been tried by slapdash methods. and all sorts of things have occurred. And I suppose the employer has finally reached a position where he's going to do it by the book, and he does it by the book. And I think what's happened in the past is that there's been too many people who have thought that they had all the answers and they were going to do things this way and that way, and it's messy and it hasn't worked. And so the unfortunate result, and we're not talking about 2 or 3 months or 2 or 3 years, we're talking about 25 years, the result is that we have a very cold, clinical approach by employers to this situation.
Now, deliberately, and it sort of puts you in it's to chill and to frighten and to get rid of any sort of humanity. It seems to be, I'll tell you about that, but just some of the tactics that is happening at the place I'm visiting today, Ken, were very interesting. Instead of just saying, we can get a bit of overtime done on Sunday afternoon or whatever because we want that job done, this particular job, because I've worked with them now, say, you're on for 4 hours. I'm not telling you what the job is, you're just on. And it's sort of, they can't even discuss the work, sort of thing.
Well, where was that, Wendy?
At
Hammersley Iron.
Yeah. And this sounded.
Well,
cutting down the relationships back to sort of just the bare essentials.
As a union official, I'm not in favour of slapdash methods about how people are offered overtime and how they work. Because I, as a worker in the iron ore industry, was a part of a system that had developed that to, I think, almost beyond an art form in terms of, workbacks and what we used to call them was job and knock. And job and knock means that you do the job and then you knock off and go home. And I've seen some of the finest metal trades people that I've ever come across develop that system. As I say, to be almost an art form, and you get with overtime, as you do, I think, in any industry, anywhere in the world, you get purple circle people who are favoured, and you get all sorts of jealousies and inter rivalries. And you also get down, you get the breakdown of relationships between workers, and the breakdown of unions. And there's a weapon, and I don't use that word lightly, that's used by employers to break workers' solidarity, to break any logical process of arriving at decisions.
You mean if you feel a strictly business-like relationship between worker and management is an easier, a better one, really, all round for the worker? Because you know where you are, which can you expect and that?
In that sense alone, in terms of things like overtime, it's a far better system for unions and I think for workers to operate in, that if there is a known system of how, how overtime will be offered and how it'll be worked. I've worked in plenty of industries where do the job and you can knock off and go home and you can go and have a beer and you can go and do this and you can go and do that. But in industries that operate up here that have been operating for a long time, I think the cowboys have had their day. And, it just breeds a multiplicity of problems.
Well, also foremen that you do favours for and don't do favours for you.
Well, yeah, that's right. And they all do favours for you until it comes to the day someone decides that they don't like you anymore, and they pull out of the desk the award or the rule book and say, well, you went home early tonight, and you or last night, and you shouldn't have, and you're sacked, and you're terminated, and you won't be getting more overtime. And we've had, my members have participated in, I would imagine, hundreds of disputes about that particular issue. Hundreds and hundreds of disputes. And, you know, they're all bitter, traumatic experiences.
In other words, what's become a practice is really not what you're entitled to, and they can always fall back on the rules.
And that's right.
And they do.
And
they do. Expect them to,
and when you do, that's right. And in many instances, I think that falls fairly and squarely right in the management's hip pocket. They make the decisions, and they dictate the pace. And as I've had it said to me in the Pilbara many a time, if you give a dog a bone, it's pretty hard to get it back.
Well, tell us your experiences in the, or your experience in the iron ore industry. When did you first start up here in the Pilbara?
Well, I first started in the Pilbara in 1972.
Perhaps we could go back a little bit further. You're Turner Federated. Tell us your apprenticeship.
Boilermaker as well.
Well, where did you do your apprenticeship?
I did my apprenticeship in Fremantle. And I originally started my apprenticeship as a blacksmith, and I changed my apprenticeship in the third year of my apprenticeship to boiler making and welding with the same company. And it was a ship repair company in the main, and did light fabrication work and jobbing work in associated industries, mainly around the waterfront in Fremantle.
Down there by the water, you showed me that, didn't you?
I first came to the Pilbara in 1972, and I think the reason that I came was my father had worked in the Pilbara and Kimberley as a roustabout and as a wall classer in the 1930s and 1940s, and I remember him talking about it sometimes, and I also remember seeing photos that he'd taken in a Browning box camera. And unfortunately, when he died, and I went through them, I was a bit older and I'd gone through those photos, none of them had been dated and stuff. And I talked about it, and I remember talking to my mother about it, and she said, well, if you want to go and have a look, have a look. So I came up and worked with a contractor in Parabadoo in January of 1973, and was there for a couple of months. And I've been in the Pilbara, on and off, ever since.
That's 13 years. That's most of your adult working life, a good deal of your adult working life.
Yes.
13 years. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So you might say you're an old hand. Well now, when did you join the Biddle company?
I started employment with Robe River at Cape Lambert, I think in July, August 1978.
Did you tell me you had some trouble getting a job
there? Yeah, I had a bit of trouble. It's a story that probably goes back to about 1974. There was a joker by the name of Norm Marlborough, who was a convener of the Metalworkers Union at Cape Lambert, and now, Wendy, he's a member of Parliament for one of the seats around the Fremantle area, I'm not too sure. And I knew him through his involvement in the union, and I was also active in the union in Perth at the time, and he on a number of occasions had said to me, come to Cape Lambert and I'll get you a job. And he sent a telegram one day and said the tickets were at the airport, and I think on another day a taxi delivered the air tickets to my home. And I didn't want to go. For some reason, I didn't want to go. I chose not to. I went and got a job somewhere, or I went and laid on the beach, or I went to Melbourne or something. And in 1978, I had been working in the Pilbara for a while. And Norm had left the Pilbara in 1977. And a jugger by the name of Laurie Kennedy was the convener of the metal workers at the Cape at the time. And I came in contact with him, and he said to me, why don't you put in for a job? So I went out and I did a welding test. I think I can't quite recall. I'll have to go back over it. I went up for the interview, and there were four jokers in the interview for this job as a boilermaker welder with Cliffs Road River Iron Associates at Cape Lambert. And I got the job, and then that night, the manager of maintenance, a bloke by the name of Keith Taylor, who has since left, retired, came around the Laurie's accommodation, and I was staying there at the time, and said, look, we can't start that bloke, there's been a mistake. The personnel officer shouldn't have interviewed those people on site. They should have only been interviewed in Perth. And I was pretty ropeable about that, and so was Laurie. And I couldn't understand why they would do that after having interviewed us. And I went back onto the job the next day, and we managed to get an interview, and they said there had been a mistake, and they were sorry and apologised and said that I should go to Perth. And I said, well, look, I'm going to do a welding test. And I did the welding test. And I think they said the welding test was all right, but it wasn't up to the standard that was required. And Laurie and a few of the blokes on the job wanted to do something about it there and then. And I said, no, I want to try by myself first. And I said, and if that fails, I'll then come back to you. In fact, if the truth be known, I didn't really want the job, I don't think. For all those years that people had been contacting me to go there and I could have started, I didn't want it. But then in late 1978, in the middle of 78, I'd become unemployed and I needed a permanent job for a little while. I went to Perth, and I never told anybody, but I paid to go to a course at CIG for 3 weeks. Bearing in mind that I'm a boilermaker welder first class by trade, I thought, well, I better brush up on the skills and make sure I get it exactly right. I paid a fair amount of money to do a test for an A-grade welding test. I passed that and was right up to scratch. I went and did the welding test with Road River, at the end of which the instructor said to me, he said, there's nothing wrong with your welding. He said, I've been told that I had to watch you very carefully, and he asked me a series of questions, and he said, look, there's no doubt that you're a welder, there's no doubt that you're competent, and there's no doubt that you've passed this test, and I'll ring the company and tell them. And I told the joker not to worry about that. I was just going into Robe River and I'd tell them myself. I went into Robe's offices in the city and told them that, and they said, oh, well, we'll wait for the official result. I then went around to see the union offices and got a hold of the senior official of the union, a chap by the name of Frank Basto, and he put in a bit of work for me, and then I spoke to Jack Marks, who at that stage was the assistant state secretary of the union, and he spoke with senior management in the Perth office, and I in the intervening period had spoken to Laurie Kennedy at Cape Lambert, and he was proceeding to see the manager of the castle as to why I hadn't got a start. I passed the welding test. They came back and said that, in fact, there was no vacancies. And I told Jack Marks that, you know, okay, I had passed the test, but the circumstances were such that there were no vacancies. I then got in touch with the people on site, and they said, look, there is a vacancy. They made approaches to the management on site. The manager in Perth, a bloke by the name of Paul Taylor, who's dead now, has since passed on.